Hey, there we go. And that is MTOI Odessa. Introduce yourself and ask your question.
My name is Tommy Chavez. I'm here with MTOI Odessa. My question is regarding the beware of false prophets teaching and identifying the anti-Messiah. Here at this congregation, I'm given the task of teaching in Spanish, and I'm wanting to get a lot of insight in this that I might understand how to properly bring it forth in Spanish. But anyway, my question is, and this is what I did. It's a long thing. I want to set it up so that I can ask my question. I have a brother who is here in Odessa. He's a younger brother. He's been a pastor now for over 10 years. I know that he hasn't had his bubble popped by the way he conducts himself and the way he teaches and speaks the word. Mike, I met him and my two other brothers, in the biological brothers, at a restaurant in the morning, and I felt that I needed to speak to them, especially to my brother as a pastor, about the beware of prophets, false prophets. I didn't throw it at him. I didn't accuse him of anything. I just mentioned that I was a part of his congregation for around 10 years before I came to the Hebraic roots and now here in MTOI.
Right.
So I was very concerned because I care about him and about the people he's speaking, that the way that he's bringing forth Yahweh's word is not to bring life to these people, but to keep them in bondage in the way he was speaking it. And because I've learned a lot because of your teachings and because of the beware of false prophets and the are you saved teachings, I wanted to share this with him.
Right.
So I brought it out. I explained to him a little bit about 2 Chronicles 7:14, about getting rid of the wickedness. And I said, it's easy for us to pray and humble ourselves and seek the Lord's face, but we don't understand what wickedness is. So I explained my definition, understanding of wickedness. And then I went into, may I speak to you about this teaching that I'm going through? It's called Beware of False Prophets. He kind of looked at me with some a strange face, and he said, yeah, go ahead. We want to hear about it. So I began with it. And I got to the point of Deuteronomy 13, where it says, do not agree with him or listen to him, nor shall your eye pardon him, nor spare him or conceal him. But you shall certainly kill him. Certainly, I understand that the killing part is not meant for today. And I understand where that came from and how the process of that through the judges that they would be brought before. But my question is, because he didn't agree with anything I was saying to him.
Shocking.
And I stayed pretty true to the teaching. So,
okay, hold on.
He got up.
All right, hold on. All right, listen. First of all, you need to release the pressure that you're feeling to have to, you know, help your brother, your physical, biological brother. He's in Yahweh's hands. Yahweh knows what he's doing, teaching as a pastor, whatever he's doing. The bubble popping always has to come from above. You can't show a teaching. It's not going to make any difference, okay? Listen to the Father and the Son teaching where I really explain that the revealing has to come from above. But I know where your heart's at. I get it, okay? And as far as the Deuteronomy 13, it's referring to someone in the body, in the community, who's starting to try to lead you astray, that's the person that needed to be killed, okay? So it's not just saying anybody out there teaching anything, because the beginning of that verse came out in the beginning of verse 9, but it starts off in verse 6, is when your brother, the son of your mother, the son of your daughter, etc., that person says that. Now, it's assuming that that person is part of the covenanted community by birth. So we're not talking about just anybody or your physical blood relative who you were not born into community, okay? You were born into mostly a Judeo-Christian world or a secular world. So you don't have that obligation. So no, we couldn't be doing these things no matter what, because we're not talking about that. Even if we were in community, your brother would not be part of that community at this point. Okay? So no pressure there. But the other side of it is, you got to understand, your heart is right. This is your brother. You love your brother. Your brother is teaching a lot of nonsense, but he thinks it's the truth. But you can't fix that. There's nothing you can do to fix that. Only the Father can fix that. And he will at some point. That's what his plan is. So I believe he will. He's going to do that for everybody. Everybody gets their bubble popped at some point. Okay? Listen to the Millennium and Kingdom teaching, so it might be in the millennium. It might not be now. But everybody gets their bubble popped at some point. So everybody has the same platform and position to make decisions from. Okay? They have to be in that same place to be able to make decisions. You can't make proper decisions without your bubble popped, because you can't see what you can't see. All right, Tommy, did that help?
Yes, sir. I understand.
Okay. But I feel the struggle. You want to, you know, really do this. I want to reach everybody too, but you just can't, right? Now, as far as you doing, what we're trying to do in Odessa is we're trying to have eventually two congregations in the same building, one in Spanish and one in English, okay, because of the amount of primary first language Spanish speakers that there are there. And so, Tommy, for making sure that you're explaining it correctly in Spanish, you and I can talk more privately to make sure that you have that information right, okay?
Right.
Okay, anything else?
No, sir. That's it. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay, go ahead and exit. Go ahead and exit the Zoom room, and then we'll get the next person up. That worked pretty good. And I think that was a good question for all of you, because I think we can all relate to having a family member, especially because if you live in the South, half your family is pastors anyway. I mean, I don't know anybody that lives down here that's not related to somebody that's in ministry. Okay, and you feel for, you know that what they're doing is not helping, okay? That's actually not helping. They think they are, but it's not, because it's further locking people into something that's just not quite right, right? So I get it. Okay, next one. We went from Texas to Canada. I like that you keep picking people I know. Mr. Zimmerman, how are you?
I'm doing good, sir. How are you?
Good. What can we do for you? So this is Alberta, Canada.
Yes, sir. So I have a quick question for you. Last night, you were talking about throwing a fleece and, not using, or you're throwing a fleece for bad examples, or, you know, you're throwing it just to kind of get what you want, this, that, and the other. My question is, when is an appropriate time to throw a fleece? Like, could you give me an example of, like, what would be an appropriate time to use that, if that makes sense?
I don't know that I would call it a fleece. I mean, I think that when you really don't know what to do, you can ask Abba to give you some sort of a sign as to what to do. I wouldn't put out a specific thing that he has to, like, I don't want to put a hoops out for the Almighty to jump through. Okay?
Right.
So, but I would be willing to say, look, if I've got opportunities and I'm really not sure which one to do, and some of them look like they could be, I don't know, ask him to close doors. That's always an easy one. Most of you do that already. Hey, when you got multiple doors, ask him to close a few. That makes it a lot simpler, okay? But to throw out, like, let this exact thing happen, then I'll know it's the right thing, you know, the enemy's listening too. And you could have that pop up, okay? And so I'm not just going to look for a fleece sort of deal. I would ask the Father to close doors, ask him to give you some insight or something that is overtly obviously him to help you with your decision. So asking for a sign, I do maybe in those more really challenging moments, but I don't think I would ask or put out a fleece, okay? By the way, doesn't Yeshua say that it's an evil and wicked and whatever generation to ask for a sign? See, so if you trust in the Almighty, just ask for him to help you, right? You don't have to ask for signs, okay?
Okay. All right, so then maybe we just need the, I need to counsel with you at some point then. That would be great. Anyways, thank you for Abba.
You're welcome. And that's really the better thing to do is to, you know, in those situations is to go get counsel, You know, you're in a challenging
yes,
moment.
Sir.
Did somebody else there want to say something?
Yeah, I got my brother here, so he has a question for you. I'm going to pass the phone over.
All right, go ahead.
There you go. Shabbat shalom, Rabbi.
Shabbat shalom.
First off, just want to say I'm so excited that this we got a Zoom going for the Zone Ones.
Yeah.
I hope it works out. I'm excited, and hopefully it all works out. But just had a quick question in regards to visiting historical places that were once considered worship sites, and just going there for the historical interest of it and visiting them. Obviously, you're not worshiping anything there. It's for like documentation and historical purposes. Is that considered still wrong?
Let me kind of answer it this way. If, for example, I'm going to an historical pagan site, I may go there for the informational part of it, but I don't need to see five of them. In other words, once I've seen one, that's all I need to see of that particular form of whatever, that particular form of false whatever. And then it's looking at it so I can now understand more what the scripture is talking about that they were doing and what that might have looked like. As opposed, you're never going to go there or should never go there in any type of respectful, worshipful type of stuff. But you're going there to say, oh, so this, now I can understand more. This is what they were doing. This is maybe why Yahweh was against it, that kind of thing. But I don't need to go to a bunch of them to understand that, okay? I mean, I've been in a Christian church at a service, and so that particular denomination, I wouldn't need to go a second time. I know what it looks like. I mean, this is when I was much younger. I wasn't keeping anything at the time. But what I'm just saying is I got the information from one visit, okay? And that was actually a place that was worshiping. I wouldn't do that today. I wouldn't go to a place that's worshiping. What I'm saying is if it's an old archaeological ancient site and you're going there to learn and maybe understand more and relate to what's in your scriptures about those people, I don't have a real problem with that per se. Okay, I don't think that's, you know, worshiping and doing anything that would be offensive to Yah. Especially if you're going there so that you can understand better what he refers to in the scriptures.
Okay, so pretty much like obviously no active, you know, worship zones. That's not what I was referring to, but as like the archaeological historic significance of a place.
Yeah.
And pretty much one and done, get the information and, you know, get out pretty much.
Right. I mean, like, you know, like if there was a, they dug up some, you know, ancient Chemosh something or other, you know, somebody might be curious to see what that was, but you don't need to go to two or three or four of them. You get all you need out of one. Because if you're really just there to get information, it should be all you're getting informationally, okay?
Okay. And
but you wouldn't be going there to try to understand them out of curiosity to consider doing what they're doing. It's more for a historical basis for your word, okay? I'm not recommending people do any of these things, but I'd be okay with that.
Okay. Is it right if I ask a clarifying question?
Sure.
All right. So what about in relation to documentation. So, like, say this is something new. And I guess to be specific, like, out here in the prairies, the Native Americans, they have, like, these, it's not like a temple, but it's like these stone circles. And a lot of them are, like they're known of, but, like, there's, like, no photographs, they're not mapped out. Is it, like, wrong to go for the sake of documentation, like, photographing and stuff like that?
What would be the reason? What would be the reason?
Just for records.
Why do you need a record of it?
Well, not specifically me, but just for historical records.
Well, then let people who care about those things do those things.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I mean, look, all that which is pagan in whatever which way it is supposed to eventually be having its memory forgotten. That's scriptural. Okay. So I don't need to document things. But like I said, I may want to understand more what they were actually doing and what that world was like so I can understand maybe more about what people were dealing with having that around them all the time. So from an historical point of view, I would not have any issue with that. But I don't know why you'd need to do that anyway. I mean, I don't have that kind of curiosity that I would actually go. Okay? But, you know. All right.
Yeah, it's just for the archaeological curiosity, but that does make sense. And, thank you so much for the clarity.
Good. Thank you for your question, Anthony. I appreciate it. Tell everybody who you are and where you are.
I'm Cindy Taylor in Georgia.
Okay.
I have a, first of all, I want to say thank you for the Zoom effort, and I too hope it works out.
It's working so far.
It's working good.
Yeah.
I have a comment just on last week's Torah study, and also it was hit on this morning in the Zone meeting about Yitzhak, and I just found it interesting in Genesis 21, verse 17, that it says, Elohim heard the voice of the boy, and then he spoke to Hagar. So it's like apparent that Abraham was teaching Yitzhak about Yahweh, just like he taught Ishmael. And then when he left at whatever age he was, 13 or so, he had that much of a foundation. And then I guess he just filled in the blanks the rest of the way, maybe from pagan religions where he ended up. But I just found that interesting that it was the boy that called out and not his mother. So, but my question is, I hope it's not a silly question. In considering your teaching on the millennium and the kingdom and using all the pieces in the box to make things work. And you say that, or the word says that it is his desire that none would perish. And so you say everybody gets to have an opportunity. So those who die and, you know, leave this life without having had that opportunity will be resurrected in the millennium for an opportunity. So is it okay, worthwhile for us to pray that when our loved ones are resurrected in that time, that just like we pray for our loved ones who are still here, we pray that the Father would pop their bubble, that they would have eyes to see, ears to hear, and a heart to receive. And we pray for that for the ones that are here now. Should we, could we be praying for those who we know or we feel like never had the opportunity, that when they get that opportunity, in other words, not trying to change their status, like praying them out of purgatory or something like that. We're not trying to change their status with prayer, just trying to hope that when they get that opportunity, that they'll see, they'll have eyes to see and ears to hear.
Look, you are perfectly appropriate with your desire for your relatives. The way I would put it, though, is that even today, okay, you have family members that will have their bubbles popped in your lifetime. You'll know it, but doesn't mean that they're going to respond right to it, okay? Some of you already know people who had their bubbles popped and then it didn't really take, so to speak. So I would be praying that when they have that touch from the Father and he reveals himself, that they'll receive. Remember, revelation is only information unless you receive it and then act upon it. So that's what I would be praying, is that when, not if, but when their bubble is popped, that they would receive and then act appropriately with what they receive.
So that goes for even those who have already passed?
Sure. I mean, okay. Look, at some point they're going to have their bubble popped. And so my prayer is not whether or not they will. They will. Because the verse says that if possible, his desire was that if possible, all men would be saved. So that means there has to be a way that would be possible, which means everybody has to get the same chance. He also says he's not a respecter of persons. He's not, all of this is in the teaching, right? So that means that everybody gets the same opportunity. And if they didn't have it, they'll get it at some point. What I would be praying is that they receive the opportunity with openness and excitement and you know, the drive to do what's necessary once they have that opportunity. I pray that now for people that are alive now, because I see people, you know, in the Zone rooms and in this room and in other places who are just not putting the energy in that's necessary to get there. They're kind of playing with it a little bit, or they're thinking like in a sort of a Christian church mindset, I've got my ticket, I'm in. No, you're not. You're not in if you don't do with what he gives you. We're going to talk about that a lot next week when we continue in the teaching on the good and trustworthy servant, and it's going to go into the parable of the sower and what happens with the kind of seed, and we talk about the parable of the talents and what are you doing with what he gives you. And if you don't do anything with it, we read that one, right? So I would be praying that they would do what they're supposed to do with it when he does it to them. you know, for them when he does it. I don't say to them, but for them.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you, Cindy. And that's for all of you in the room. When you do come in, did you have another question?
I wanted to pass to Dell if I could.
Oh, yeah. Let Dell go ahead. Just for all of you, just because I know you doesn't mean everybody else knows you. So don't forget to introduce yourselves and where you're from. So this is going to be Dell Taylor.
And he's I'm from Idaho, but I reside in Georgia with my lovely bride. So I'm not from here. My question is Matthew 22:8-10. It says, then he said to his servants, the wedding feast indeed is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Therefore, go into the street corners, and as many as you find, invite to the wedding feast. And those servants went out into the street corners and gathered all of whom they found, both wicked and good. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. Is the wedding taking place during the millennium or at the end of the millennium? And so is this applying to those people that are in the millennial reign?
Okay, so it's not necessarily talking about the wedding, okay? The starts off in verse 1, this is a parable. Okay, speaking to them in parables. And the parable has to do with the kingdom of heaven, the reign of the heavens is like. So this is telling you what the reign of the heavens is like. It's not telling you what the wedding feast will be like, okay? And so in the millennial reign, you're going to have the good and the wicked and all these others who are going to be gathered and they're going to get their opportunity. There's a metaphor going on here that's a lot deeper that I won't have the time to explain now. But just understand, we have to always look at context. So what the context first is okay, so who's speaking? Yeshua is speaking and he's talking in parables, it says that, which means that it's not meant to be taken literally, but we're supposed to understand the point he's trying to make. And he even tells us up front, the point is, the kingdom of heaven is like. So now I'm going to give you an idea. So now we have to start to break apart the parable to see what it tells us about the kingdom of heaven, not about the wedding. Okay?
Okay.
And that would be a whole teaching in itself.
Okay.
Okay, but I want all of you to kind of catch that. Context is everything, which means you always have to be asking these questions. If you don't know who's speaking, always go back to make sure you know who's speaking. Also ask the question, who's the audience? Is he talking? In this case, is it Yeshua who's talking? We know that's Yeshua talking, but who's he talking to? Is he talking to everybody? Is he talking to his disciples? Who is he talking to? Okay? Then we also got to understand maybe where is this happening in time? Is there anything happening time-wise on the timeline of history that is significant to why he's talking about what he's talking about? Then you got to ask the question, well, what is he saying and why is he saying it? What is the issue being addressed? Because we only have so much in this book, and none of it's wasted, so why is it in here? And so this was one of the easier ones, because you go back to verse 1. I mean, we started off in verse 9 and 10, but we got to go back to the beginning and say, okay, he's saying this is about the kingdom of heaven is like. So that means that the rest of this, which he says, we've told it's a parable, right? He said he spoke to them again in parables. So it's not to be taken literally, but it's to give you a picture of something about the kingdom, okay? So, just like we're told that in my Father's house are many rooms, right? Well, it's not really a house with rooms that we're going to, but it's to give us an idea of a space being provided and that kind of thing. So there's more to it. All right, next. Oh, sure, your brother's got to speak, so now you have to speak. I see how you are. Except you're not in Canada, though. All right, what was that?
I was just going to say, that was not planned, my brother speaking.
All right, so this is Anna.
Yes, originally from Canada. I'm now in California with my husband. So my question is, what do we do with companies and businesses that are very big with supporting the LGBTQ movement or abortion or just any other of those political things that we don't agree with? Because, like, my concern is if the answer is boycotting,
no,
and not purchasing from them, but limits a lot of our abilities to be able to buy stuff.
All right. Well, first, you need to stop spinning in circles. Stand still. Okay. Now. All right. So We've experienced this before. We had some people that we worked with many years ago that had an issue with various businesses because of what they supported. The point is this. Number one, you don't know what all the businesses out there support. There are a few that you know because they get publicly, you know, outed in some way. But they're all supporting stuff you wouldn't want to support. But that's not why you're doing business. You're doing business because they have a product that you want at a price that you think is fair, and that's what you're there for, okay? So I wouldn't be overly concerned with who you're doing business with and what they're supporting. I just want to make it real, because seriously, most businesses that you're dealing with are supporting things you wouldn't support on some level, all right, to some degree. So then you can't do business with anybody, all right? So I think you need a much stronger reason, specifically with a specific business, okay, that is a reason why you wouldn't work with them, other than the idea that they're supporting a thing like abortion or whatever that you don't agree with. Now, bear in mind, you're more than welcome to not give money to a place that you feel is going to use it to support something you don't agree with. So you're welcome to do that. So I'm not telling anybody you shouldn't do this. I'm just saying is, if you really take it out to where the nth degree, as they say, you're not going to be able to do business with anybody. Did I answer it?
Yes, that did. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, I got to see almost your whole family. All right, that's great. All I need to see is Chris and Terry, the parents, and the other 14 kids in that house. All right. They do a lot of fostering and adopting, so always a lot of kids. All right. Next one. Okay.
Hello.
Can you hear me? Yep. Tell everybody who you are and where you're from.
My name is Shakara. I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. So, question about Revelation 17. What are they talking about with the hidden manna and renewed name?
Okay. Hold on. Revelation.
Chapter 2, verse 17.
Okay. So, we're talking about the different church areas or assemblies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So here it says, to him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I shall give him a white stone, and on a stone a renewed name written, which no one knows except him who receives it. Okay, so let's kind of break this down. Again, it's parable, so it's meant to kind of picture certain things. So a certain level of parable here. So to the one who overcomes, so go make sure to listen to the teaching. I think I covered this in the He Who Overcomes teaching. So if you haven't heard that, go listen to that, because that's this whole section is where that teaching comes from, right? All of these assemblies have the phrase, and to the one who overcomes, this is what you get, okay? So it's all about overcoming. And so if you're an overcomer, then you're going to get what's called the hidden manna to eat. So what is manna? Manna is food, all right? And we're told that the good stuff is eating of Yeshua. He's the bread of life. He says, eat of me and live, right? And so can we not understand then, of course, and what he is as food is the word, because we can't live on bread alone, but on every word. So the hidden manna would be the not revealed yet word, okay?
Okay.
Which you get hopefully from me every week. But you can't receive that without the bubble popping, and it won't make sense what I say unless the bubbles pop. And so when you've become an overcomer, he's going to give you some of that hidden manna to eat, okay? And with that hidden manna, you're going to also get a stone with a renewed authority or name on it. So you're now going to understand a renewing of proper understanding of the authority. So your whole understanding of the Father and the Son is different now. At least it should be. So that's part of the hidden manna. You did not see them right. That information had been hidden by the other system from you. Okay? So is that kind of making sense?
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Can I go down to verse 26?
Sure.
If Yah is ruling, then why is it that we need authority over the nation? If he's already ruling, what nations do we have authority over?
Okay, you got to understand that Revelation, a lot of this is taking place during the millennium. So there's going to be authority over nations happening. We don't get to the end of the millennium until chapter 19 and 20, right? So we get to the very end. So all of this is happening during, okay? And so authority being given, so he's talking about that these things will be at a point you'll have authority over nations for 1,000 years.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes, sir.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you. All right, next. You guys keep picking only people I have relationships with and I know. It's amazing. Where'd you find this guy? You were just here last week. Look at how you play. I like the way you play. You don't live here right now, so you get to be on the Zone meeting.
Hi, everybody.
This is Olivier. So you're in Houston right now, right?
Yeah, I'm in Houston.
Okay.
So I have a...
We could tell you're in Houston by your accent.
Yeah. Deep South. I have a follow-up question on the topic of what to wear, wearing the tzitzit. I'm going to go soon in Europe, and I was actually thinking about that. I was thinking about asking the question before this morning. Not very comfortable about showing them the places I'm going to go, so I understand that it's okay to tuck them in there.
Yes, I would say that if you feel reasonably confident that there could be a risk, okay, then I would tuck them in. All right. I mean, look, we don't have protests here in Cleveland, so I'm not worried about things in Cleveland. But in a lot of the big cities, there are protests happening, and people are being attacked, and people are getting all kinds of things happening. And so wisdom would say, yes, tuck them in. If you're traveling through Europe, especially in the bigger cities or in an area where you don't know how people are. I mean, if you know where you are and where you live, it's not an issue, then don't worry about it where you are and where you live. But if you're going especially to someplace you don't know, I would tuck them in until there's evidence that it's safe. I wouldn't just, like, wear them out and then realize it's not safe and you might be too late.
What are your thoughts about, so around here, like in Chattanooga, for example, I'm thinking about Matteo, because he wears his seats and he wears them to school. Is it safe for him to continue doing so?
Yeah, I think that it should be safe here. I don't see a lot of emotional stuff happening here. You know, the only people that are going to know what he's wearing are going to either be Messianics, because it's not that, and a few Jews. It's not a whole lot of people here that would know either way and that kind of thing. So it's still your choice. You can choose not to have him wearing. He's not 20 anyway, so he doesn't necessarily have to be wearing them, all right? But I would, you know, use, you know, some more heightened awareness as to, you know, being safe.
All right. Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. All right. Appreciate the question. And I like the idea that Matteo wears the tzitzit. Good job, Matteo. Yeah. Okay. All right. Next.
Thank you, Rabbi. My question is actually from Genesis 47. Well, really 28 to the end of the chapter. And it's talking about, you
wait,
know...
Wait, hold on. Wait, you got to introduce yourself and where you're from since I don't have a picture.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Al Zick, and I'm from South Carolina.
I mean, I knew that. I recognized your voice.
I thought you would.
But they don't know who you are. Okay.
Okay.
What chapter are you in, Al?
Chapter 47 of Genesis.
Right.
And it really starts in... verse 28, where Jacob is living in Egypt, and he's asking to be taken back to be buried with his fathers when he dies.
Right.
Now, I see that same theme, I guess, if you will. Well, it's especially in 1 Kings, you know, it talks about the king, how many years he reigned, and then he slept with his fathers, and whether he was buried with his fathers or not. If he was a good king, he was buried with his father. If he was a bad king, he was buried somewhere else, is what I'm seeing. And I don't see anywhere in Torah that we're told, okay, to do this. So I think it's some type of tradition.
Yes.
But I'm wondering why, you can see this all through the Tanakh, pretty much. Why they're doing this? Why are all these people being buried with their ancestors, I guess, is the question.
First of all, I'd be forced to guess, okay? So this is going to be my guess. The idea of grave robbing and other kind of defilements is not a new one, okay? This is why Abraham made sure to get and purchase Now, I'm sure back with his fathers, there was a place that they could have done things, but now he was out on his own, and so he purchased a piece of property to be his property for their burials, okay? And it was then secured by a perpetual ownership lease, so to speak, like he owned that property for his for generations, and this would protect that site, all right? Instead of just being randomly buried anywhere. Because even today, all right, we don't just generally bury anybody anywhere. We purchase a burial plot in a cemetery somewhere that we own and has a certain level of protections on it. So that would be my guess as to what that's all about. The rest of it is tradition. All of it really is tradition. It's not a whole lot about funerals or anything else in Scripture. So,
right. I guess my question is more about, you know, during the resurrection, did they believe that they would be resurrected together, that they'd be in the same place, or does it not work that way?
I don't. Well, it doesn't work that way, but I don't know that they would think of that. Although there are a lot of people that want to be buried over near the Mount of Olives because they think that that's going to be some advantage. Okay, so there's lots of people that have done that over the centuries. So I don't have any thought that being resurrected, that traveling distance is going to be an issue. So okay. I don't think being closer or further away from something is going to be a problem. And as I've told some of you, some of the older ones especially, or unhealthy ones who are worried about, you know, if they pass and what's going to happen, I say, and I've told all of them, I have no doubt that I will be able to find you. And you'll be able to find your loved ones. We'll be able to find people without a problem. Okay? I don't know why I know that. That's my impression. I feel like very confidently that relocation or locating each other is not going to be a problem. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you, Al. All right. You're next.
Welcome. Hi, Rabbi.
Tell everybody who you are.
Oh, I'm Annabelle Gonzalez, and I'm from Odessa, Texas.
There you go.
I have a question on Genesis 20:16.
Okay.
Where it says, I'm sorry, what was that? Where it says, and to Sarah he said, see, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. See, it is to you a covering of eyes before all who are with you and before all others, and you are cleared before everyone. What is this on, like, why did she end up being cleared, and what does that 1,000 pieces mean? Like,
all right, so what just happened, right? So they were dealing with Abimelech, right? They were dealing with Abimelech, and they had this whole wife-sister snafu going on, and so Abimelech decides, in order to make restitution, okay, he takes sheep and cattle and male and female servants, he gives them to Abraham, and then he returns Sarah to his wife to him, and now he's trying to make it clear in a public sense, kind of like what we see with Abraham when he's purchasing the land in a very public sense with witnesses, etc. So he's making it clear, I've given your brother these things, and now I'm also giving him 1,000 pieces of silver. See it to you as a covering of eyes before all. In other words, this should make things right in front of everyone. I've restored things. And so that means that the situation is cleared. Like, that clears up the situation. This is his way of saying, see, I've done all this, so we're good. Like, no harm, no foul type of thing, okay?
Okay. I have another one. It's not a question. It's kind of like maybe a connection.
Okay, do it real quick. That's okay. You can do it real quickly.
Okay. Chapter 24 in Genesis also. Verse 6, where he says, and Abraham said to him, beware lest you take my son back there. And this is just my mind thinking. Also with verse 35, where he says, and Yahweh has blessed my master exceedingly, and he has become great, and he has given him flocks and herds, and, you know, so forth. He's exceedingly blessed. And my connection in my head is like when we leave to follow Yahweh, and the people that were left behind, was this an opportunity for, I mean, like it was an opportunity that when the servant went back to show those people or his family that the decision that he made to follow Yahweh was surely from Yahweh and has blessed them. And in me and my connection was that, like us, that people can look at us and see that we have truly been blessed by following Yahweh. Am I kind of seeing that correctly?
Partially. Okay, so you are seeing correctly the last part, that when people see the blessing, they should see that it's connected to your relationship with Yahweh. The whole taking the son back thing, think of it this way. The man goes out, finds a woman. She refuses to go back with him. So he says, should I come then and get Isaac and bring him to her? And Abram's like, no, because then he'll never come back here and do what I need him to do here. He's going to go over there and stay with her over there. And I need him over here. He's got the promises to continue and the obligation to take over the tribe or the family. You know, this is more basically simple, okay? He said, if you bring him over to her, he's going to stay there. There's a good chance he'll just stay there. If she doesn't want to come here and he ends up wanting her and he wants to stay, he's going to stay with her. I will lose my son and I need him to do certain things. So no, you bring her here. Okay?
Kind of like us not going back neither, right?
To some degree, but I don't think it's so much like that because he's not been there. He's saying, but if you bring my son there, he's going to meet her family and meet her, and she's not going to want to come here. He's going to want to stay with her and all this kind of stuff. So he says, no, you don't bring my son there. He needs to stay here. All right. All right, next.
I'm Gerald Monroe from Trinidad and Tobago.
Okay. Awesome.
This is the first time I'm actually getting to, so I thank you for this opportunity. I have two questions, please. The first one is, could you explain about casting lots, and is it something that we can do at this point in time? Or
I didn't catch about casting rocks.
No,
casting lots. Casting lots. Yeah, no, I don't understand what they did and how they did that. I mean, you know, there's lots of information about what people think by historical evidence, but it's not something we do today. No. But it was something they did then. I don't understand it. We're not connected to that culture anymore in the history, that part of time. But it's not something we do now.
All right. And the second question is, a friend of mine, he's working in Torah and he has a couple of kids. They're pretty young, like around 10, 11 years old. And they asked him a question recently. Dad, how do we know what we are doing is the correct thing? So I wanted to find out from you, you know, how do we respond to a 10-year-old child when they ask a question like this?
Okay. You say simply because Rabbi said so. No. I did have another joke, too. Instead of casting lots, we now go back to the eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Okay, so anyway, the question is a great question. The first thing I would do is tell the child that's a great question. Okay, how do we know? And you say that it's a personal journey, and so then you have to explain how you know. And if you would ask me how I know, it's because I see the evidence in my life in connection to the Word. The Word says it, I see it happen. I see it happen historically, I see it happen personally. And so it's a journey of experience. You know, Yeshua says, and other parts in the verses, in Scripture talks about, when you've tasted of, right? So when you've tasted of. Now, I have a journey, I'm 60 years old. I've got a lot of years that, you know, it's a reasonable amount of history that I can look at for experience. I'm not like 15 or 20 years old. And I can tell you, I've been not in this walk, and I've been in this walk more than once. And I can see a clear contrast. So on the first level of understanding of all of this is Abba wouldn't ask you to do something if it didn't work. So you have to have evidence that it works. Okay? And that's where, if you talk to anybody who's covenanted, they will all tell you their life is better because it works. Okay? Look, we have a thing called faith because we're dealing with a being we never see. We don't really get to interact directly in a way that's physically tangible. So we have this belief in something we can't see. But there's still evidence of what we can't see. Okay? Life with and life without. There's evidence. All right? Okay? So, I mean, it'd be something as simple as you remember eating food before you were a smoker and what it tasted like. And then you were a smoker and you've realized you don't even taste food anymore. It wrecks your taste buds. Then you quit, and all of a sudden you can taste things again. I mean, there's life with and life without. And so when a 10-year-old asks a question, I have to say to the 10-year-old, this is going to be a personal journey you make. I don't want you to believe this just because I do, but I want you to understand that I do believe it, and this is why, right? But you're going to have your own journey, your own experience, to come into a relationship with the creator of the universe. Did that help?
Yes, it did. Thanks a lot, Rabbi. I'll pass on your information.
Okay.
Shabbat shalom.
Okay, Shabbat shalom. All right, so, you know, for all of you, I think that's a really important thing that we have to understand. We're taking a ton of this just on faith. Well, we are. But we're not just blind faith, okay? Although they were a pretty good band. But we're not blind faith, for all you older folks. We have evidence. We have experience. We've seen. We've tasted. And so all I know is that my life and others, countless others that I've talked to in their lives, work better or even just works. Maybe their lives didn't work at all before this. Now their life works. Like things work and make sense and they function. Not perfectly, but a whole lot better than they did before because of belief and then trusting and walking this out. And through that experience, you engage the vertical. You engage with the Almighty. And then you actually start to have that relationship. Look, go back to Deuteronomy 10:12, which, you know, is the framework that you start off by first fearing and awing and reverencing that there's a creator. Then you do what he says and you realize it works. And he gave it to you because he loves you. Then you fall in love with him because now you have a relationship developing out of the experience. Not the experience of like, oh, no, the experience of living life his way and having it work. Okay? Not just like some music and altar call experience that got you all emotional. But getting emotional because your life doesn't suck anymore. And you're not in the pit where you were. And you have hope now. And you have, there's a future that you are anchored onto. And life makes a lot more sense. Next question.
I'm back.
That's good.
Okay, so in Matthew this time.
Okay, you're in Matthew.
Chapter 13.
Well, it was about time somebody did something in between Genesis and Revelation. I kept going back and forth to the ends of the book.
13 verses 11 through 15, where he's basically saying that the people are not going to understand what he's talking about.
Yep.
Why even talk to them then? Why tell them the parables if you know they're not going to get it? And then in verse 36, it was given for the disciples to know the meaning, but they still didn't even understand.
All right. So I don't know how much of the teachings you've heard over the time you've been with us, but one of the things that I've said in several of the teachings is that this is not, first of all, it's not just written, you know, to them, but it's also for others later, right? So sometimes he did things knowing others would get it later. Also, I've also taught that you were not supposed to understand this without a facilitator. This is supposed to be taught.
Yeah.
Okay? So the disciples didn't understand because he hadn't taught them yet. And when he teaches them, he says, then he starts to answer their question. Well, what does that mean? Do you understand what I just said? They're like, no, we don't understand. Can you explain it? And then he explains it. And even then, they may not fully understand it because they haven't gotten enough other things understood first. Same thing with the teachings that I've done. I'm not claiming to be like Yeshua. I'm just giving it because it's his stuff that he's giving me, right? Mm-hmm. So it is going to be similar. What I'm saying is you can listen to a teaching for the first time, especially if you haven't heard enough of the other teachings to connect them together, and then listen to other stuff that I've done and go back, and now it makes sense in a way that it didn't the first time, on levels you didn't even see the first time. And that's the way that the word is here. Until you have enough of a foundational understanding of certain basic things, what he says only makes some sense to you, not full sense to you. And he's only was working with these guys a few years. He didn't have them for a long time. And depending on where we are in Matthew 13, we're early in the journey here with them. Okay? So this early on in the journey, he hasn't spent that much time with them. So even when he explains something, they're going to be going, okay, I'm not really sure, right? I don't get it yet. And it takes time to piece that all together. Does that help?
Yes, yes.
Good.
Talk to you again in a minute. I'll be back in a
minute. This is becoming four people's personal Zoom.
Thank you, Rabbi.
It's Al again. Okay.
Yes, it's Al Albert Zick from South Carolina.
Yeah.
Okay. Zone one. Yeah. This question is about, I don't know if you have this problem, so maybe, but it's more about like, what do you do to sort of shut down after Sabbath starts, you know? I guess the best thing I could do is give you an example. Like last night, I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about how, you know, what do I need to do to get a better job? And I've got this project and that project, and I'm thinking about, you know, my son who passed away. And
so how do you shut that down so you can actually have the peace of Shabbat? Okay.
Yes.
All right. So first of all, recognize that we have, and I've talked about this in a few teachings, the idea of transition time is needed. Which means you have to give yourself time and recognize everybody's different. Some people can transition quicker, you know, their head can switch gears quicker than others. And sometimes you can switch gears for different things differently. Like you can go from work to friends maybe easier than you go from work to Sabbath. So you are kind of changing, putting a different hat on, so to speak, right? So once you recognize your need transitionally, then you have to give yourself that kind of time on Friday prior to Shabbat to make the transition. So what that may mean is, if you've got a bunch of stuff that's just sitting on your brain, like a job you need to do or a job you need to look for or some other thing, then what you may want to do is write down that you're going to do this after Shabbat. Like, because the brain's going to want you to deal with it and tends to handle this. I do this when people have trouble sleeping because their heads just won't stop to go to sleep. So then assure yourself that you'll deal with it in the morning. Well, the same thing with Shabbat. Just say, I will deal with this. Tell your brain, we're going to deal with this as soon as the sun goes down. Okay? As soon as Shabbat's over, we'll deal with this. But that writing it down sort of helps the brain to realize, yes, you are committed to deal with it. Because the brain's afraid you're going to forget and not deal with it. Okay? And so the more pressing and urgent, the more it's going to be sitting there driving you a little crazy. So you have to be able to assure yourself, I'm taking a time out, it's called Shabbat, but I will deal with this, write it down, set an alarm on your phone so it even, do anything to help convince yourself that it's going to get dealt with, just not now, all right? That you're going to take this time out, this rest called Shabbat. And that should help at least a little bit. But it just takes transition time, okay? It takes transition time. Elder used to talk about it, you know, coming from a job as a police officer. You can't just go from the police officer to husband at home without transition time because your head is in a totally different place. How do you get to the calm, wonderful house and it's supposed to be loving and everything from the intensity of anything could be going wrong at any moment and dealing with the kind of dangerous nonsense that you're dealing with? Okay? So you have to have transition time, and that may take 20 minutes. It could take an hour. It could take something. Okay? So recognize what you need. And then give yourself some time to experiment. What kinds of things can you do that seem to take that pressure off the brain? Okay? And then let's say it pops up again Friday night. It's after sundown. It's already Shabbat. It pops up again. Take that moment to remind yourself, we are going to deal with this as soon as Sabbath is over. You know? You're going to have a little debate with yourself, but that's just the way it is. Your subconscious mind is still trying to get you to deal with something. See, people, by the way, if you have trouble falling asleep, a lot of it's because you have a bunch of stuff you haven't processed. And so until you do, you're not falling asleep, okay? I fall asleep really quickly. And it's not because I get everything processed. It's because I've got my system convinced that I will deal with it when I wake up. Now, there are times where certain things I'm excited about or just came up that were pressing, then I get up and I write it down so that I know that when I wake up, it's right there, I'm going to deal with it. Then I tend to be able to then fall right to sleep. It's the same kind of thing. You can't rest at night or for Shabbat if your mind is running on other things. Does that help, Al?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
No problem.